Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Have you ever participated in a Twitter poster conference? Coming up in the podcast, IOP Publishing's Tim Smith will explain the concept and talk about a free international event that IOP Publishing is hosting next week. But first, let's meet David LaCrone, who spent much of his career at NASA working on the Hubble Space Telescope. David has just published a book that chronicles some of the highs and lows of working on that extraordinary instrument. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope, which launched on the 24th of April, 1990. The telescope has delivered many astonishing images over the years, and I'm sure that many listeners must wonder what it was like to work on the NASA team that launched Hubble, and also on the team that kept it running all these years. I'm joined down the line from Silver Spring, Maryland, by David LaCrone, who worked on the Hubble project for over 30 years. David retired in 2009, and as well as being Emeritus Senior Scientist at the Goddard Space Flight Center, he has also written a book about his experiences, and that book is called Life with Hubble. Hi, David.
Hello, Hamish.
Now, you were involved in the Hubble Space Telescope project for over 30 years, from 1976 to 2009. What positions did you hold at NASA during that period?
I began on the Hubble project as a project scientist responsible for the scientific instruments, five of them, that were being designed and built to go on Hubble at the time of its original launch. And then I was in that position for over a decade. And thereafter, I became deputy to the senior project scientist, Al Baugus, was his name. And then when Al retired in 1990, I obtained the position of senior project scientist replacing Al. And all that time, I was also had the title of astrophysicist at Goddard. And in my spare time, I was the head of the astronomy branch, which contained about 15 PhD astronomers that I had to look out for. And there was, of course, the terrible tragedy of the loss of Columbia. And after that, NASA set up an advisory board called the NASA Engineering and Safety Center to look into the safety aspects of all of the NASA projects. And I was asked to serve as the chief scientist on the NASA Engineering and Safety Center. So I had a kind of a versatile portfolio.
And your book begins with the discussion of the severe spherical aberration problem with the telescope's optics that was discovered after the launch. I mean, that must have been a very bleak period at NASA. Can you give us an idea of what the mood was like there when the problem was first found?
Well, the initial mood after many weeks of trying to focus the telescope and being unable to bring it into a sharp focus, when we found out that we had spherical aberration and there was really not much or anything we could do about it, it was initial shock, disbelief, and then in some cases, sadness, certainly embarrassment for everybody involved, public embarrassment in particular, because the telescope had gotten so much attention and within the public and the press. Some people who were involved became very angry and left the project. Others decided that the dream of Hubble was still a very worthwhile objective, and we should continue to pursue that dream and try to to solve the problem and get back into the operation we had expected originally for the telescope.
And I mean, solving the problem, you know, to me sounds like, it was a real triumph over adversity and, like a film, an adventure film of, you know, coming up with a plan and then going into, you know, into space and pulling it off. It must have been an incredible amount of work. How was it done and who did it?
Well, there are sort of two parts to the story. There's a formal part. Of course, NASA wanted very badly to know what had gone wrong and could we characterize the problem, how badly aberrated was the telescope. And so a couple of different independent review boards were appointed with optical experts and engineering experts to go off and sort of do a forensic analysis of this problem and come back and tell us what went wrong and why did it go wrong. The other part, the part of the story I most like, and I love this part actually, and I tell it in my book, is kind of the informal part of the situation. The early images that came down, we launched in April of 1990, and just within 4 to 6 weeks, we had images. We had images down even earlier than that, and the teams were going off and looking at them 4 to 6 weeks later. But just a few days after the first images came down, John Trauger, who is an astronomer working on a second generation instrument for Hubble called Wide Field Planetary Camera Number 2, was sitting in his office in Pasadena, and in walked Aidan and Marjorie Meinel. The Meinels are very respected, revered figures in the world of astronomy and astronomical optics. And Aidan Meinel founded the Kitt Beaker, was one of the founders of the Kitt Beaker National Observatory. And Aidan said, "John, could I see these very early images that were taken with the Wide Field Planetary Camera, the first version of the camera, a few days ago on Hubble?" And so John brought those images up on the screen, and Aidan sort of looked for a few seconds and said, "You've got spherical aberration."
Oh, no.
just by casual inspection. And then a couple of weeks later, both Aidan and John Trauger were at a conference of optical experts in Southern California. And they had gone to the evening meal, a buffet, and they were standing in line. And Aidan said, "You remember those?" And they were next to each other, actually, in the food line. And Aidan said to John, "You recall those images you showed me?" And I said, "It had spherical aberration." He said, "Don't you have mirrors within your instrument at a particular place?" And John said, "Yes, there's a place called the pupil." And John said, "Sure." And Aidan said, "Well, you ought to be able to fix the problem by just correctly figuring the little mirrors, of size of a U.S. nickel, just correctly figure those mirrors, and they can exactly compensate for the spherical aberration. So the camera won't even know it had a spherically aberrated telescope image coming into it. And so John thought, "Wow, that's a thought." And he went back to Pasadena to JPL and spent several days with an optics engineer at JPL going through different scenarios. And they found that by all means, they could make this correction in that camera. And that word got back to NASA. John brought it back to Greenbelt here at Goddard Space Flight Center at a meeting of our science working group. And so that took care of like 50% of Hubble's science program. If we could make that correction, put it in John's second generation wide field camera, and launch that as early as possible back up to Hubble and replace the original Wide Field Planetary Camera with John Trauger's version, then that would correct our workhorse camera and give us about 50% of our science objectives. But what about the other 50%? So Riccardo Giacconi at that time was the head of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. The institute was responsible for planning the science program for the telescope. And he was quite upset that only 50% of the science was going to be restored and not 100%. So he commissioned a separate team with NASA's blessing, to go off and look at how would you solve the entire problem, not just the problem in the Wide Field Planetary Camera. And so two brilliant engineers, Jim Crocker, who worked at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and a man named Merk Bottema, a Dutch optical physicist who worked for Ball Aerospace in Colorado, came up, and I won't go into the details here, read my book, but they came up with an ingenious scheme for inserting another device into the telescope, the back of the telescope, replacing one of the four science instruments that were back there. This device was called COSTAR, Corrective Optics Space Telescope Axial Replacement. They call it COSTAR. And it basically had an arm that came out of the top of the instrument and inserted pairs of mirrors in the optical beam for each individual instrument. So there were four there. An instrument was taken out, replaced with COSTAR. That left three science instruments and COSTAR in the very back end of the telescope. And the informal part of this was the scheme for the arm coming out of the top of the COSTAR instrument and putting these pairs of mirrors in the optical beam of the telescope so they would correct spherical aberration. Came to Crocker in a shower in Germany at a meeting of this committee, and he noticed the European-style showers, the head would slide up and down on a pole.
Oh, yeah, we've got one of those. Could, yeah,
yeah, and you can actually tip and tilt the head in various directions. And he said, well, let's just do that inside Hubble. Let's have a pole, you know, extend out into the optical beam of the telescope, and we'll have these pairs of mirrors on the pole, and they can tip and tilt to correctly align with the telescope's optics. And voila, we have a solution for three of additional scientific instruments. And so, you know, there were formal studies and detailed reports written and very detailed new specifications written about what the telescope turned out actually to be in orbit as opposed to what it was intended to be when it was ground on the mirrors were ground on Earth. But I love the informal stories about how creative people are very, very smart and experienced people, both, in fact, at the same time, could actually have these brilliant ideas just sort of off the cuff that led to a solution to the problem and saving NASA's bacon.
And you said earlier that people at NASA had various reactions to the aberration problem. Were you sort of in the positive camp? Did you think all along that, you know, we could sort this out if we really tried, if we really thought about it?
I was rather young compared to many of the other people. And I was sort of a junior astronomer at that time. And so I just by nature was optimistic. And I also had some personal experience in the past working with mathematical correction techniques that you could use to sharpen up an image. And so I sensed that there ought to be some way to mathematically work on our apply mathematical algorithms to our images to sharpen them up. And it wouldn't be a full solution to the problem. The images would become noisier and you'd still have issues that would prevent you from actually doing the most important science Hubble was originally intended to do. But at least you could do some science so that it wasn't a complete washout. So yeah, I was optimistic. And in fact, there was a little after we had a critical meeting at Goddard where everybody agreed, okay, we have this serious problem and there's not a whole lot we can do about it at this point. We've tried everything and nothing works. After that meeting was over, we went off into a little side office in the vicinity, and there were several of the original Hubble senior engineering people in there. And one of them, the lead systems engineer, said, "Break out the hemlock, boys," which kind of implied they all ought to commit suicide. And I responded, "No, I think you should break out the scotch because we're really gonna need you guys to solve this problem."
And in your book, you mention the space shuttle and you know the very important role that it played in, well, I suppose, in fixing this problem and then maintaining Hubble. I think there were five servicing missions altogether, and I think you were involved with all of them. Can you give us an idea of what it was like planning and executing those missions?
Yeah, I mean, the shuttle is absolutely critical to Hubble, both in terms of fixing this problem, because thank goodness we had built both Hubble and the space shuttle had been built to service Hubble. So when this sort of unexpected emergency arose, we were already well positioned to send astronauts up in the space shuttle to carry up the new Whitefield planetary camera, to carry up the COSTAR device, and actually some other components that weren't working so well, to carry up replacements for those. So the plan all along was to be able to do that, thank goodness. And if we hadn't been able to do that, then today I think Hubble would just be an embarrassing relic still orbiting the Earth, most likely. And, you know, the continued butt of jokes. But as it was, we reclaimed the observatory as the absolutely phenomenal world-class new device that it was intended to be. I worked on all five servicing missions, beginning with servicing mission one. I did become senior project scientist in 1992, January. And so the first servicing mission to correct the optical problem was scheduled for late 1993. And so I was on board as the lead scientist on the Hubble project at Goddard for the better part of 2 years before we flew that first mission, which, I mean, they're just incredibly exciting. I call them high adventure because it's amazing. On the one hand, the planning for each of those missions is incredibly detailed and fastidious. And of course, a lot of new equipment has to be designed and built to fly on those missions to be put in the telescope. And you have to have provisions for protecting all this new equipment in space. So you have to have proper carriers and want to make sure everything survives the launch. So the structure within the payload bay of the Hubble has to be just so. But then the planning is so meticulous. It's done years and then leading up to the mission, many, many months in advance. To think of everything that could go wrong, to think of every procedure and how you would respond to that, to think of every procedure, every tiny little step that each astronaut has to take while out in the payload bay working on the Hubble telescope. It's like building Swiss watches. It's just incredibly detailed and everything has to be planned in advance. So, I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut, but I think in retrospect, maybe not, because I don't have that patience and attention to the fine detail that those guys need. And then they practice, constantly practicing everything they have to do. So, so there were five servicing missions. The first one, repair Hubble. Second one in 1997 was actually the first mission to put new instrumentation that had originally been planned. In other words, it was the first normal servicing mission to Hubble. And that was the mission in which we discovered that the outer insulation on the outside of the telescope was kind of tearing and ripping and cracking and so forth. And people became very alarmed about that. But it turned out to really not be a terribly bad issue. We had to fly another kind of emergency mission in 1999 around Christmas time because our gyros had failed. And that was the Achilles heel of Hubble. We had gyroscopes that were essential to pointing and positioning and fine settling the telescope. And those just tended to fail. They fail much more frequently than we had expected them to. So come late 1999, we had to have three gyros operating at any given time. We carried six on board, so there were always three spares. And three of the gyros had failed, four of the gyros had failed. So we were down to just two, and that wasn't enough at that time to keep the telescope doing science observations. So the telescope was down totally for about 6 weeks. And in late 1999, we flew this urgent mission to replace the gyros and a few other things. Then in 2002, March 1st, we flew another so-called normal servicing mission and put in a really powerful new camera called the Advanced Camera for Surveys. And there were other interesting little sidelights in that mission, like replacing a power switching station that was not intended to be replaced. And so you had to turn the telescope completely off electrically, and that was a no-no. No one ever really wanted to do that. And as it was, after it had been turned off, it kept getting colder and colder. And unfortunately, one of the astronauts had a water leak in their spacesuit, and they had to take 2 hours to reconfigure a new spacesuit, and the telescope just kept getting colder. Well, luckily, the thermal engineers back at Goddard were thinking about all of the ramifications of this, and they figured kind of on the fly a way to start turning things back on and warming them back up in a certain sequence. And that was a bit of heroism on their part that saved the day and saved the telescope. We went through a long period. We had originally planned the final servicing mission, it was called 4, but we had actually split one of the missions into two parts, SN3A and SN3B, because of that gyro emergency in 1999. So SN4 was originally scheduled to go in 2002, and then 2003, and then 2004, and then 2005. And then, of course, we had the failure of Columbia, the tragic crash or breakup in descent of Space Shuttle Columbia and the loss of its 7 crew members. Mm-hmm. And so NASA stopped the shuttle program, put it on hold for a while indefinitely, and the administrator of NASA decided these servicing missions are just too risky. We've lost 2 shuttles, Challenger in 1987, I think it was, and now Columbia. And he says, I don't want this to be on my conscience of, you know, losing more astronauts. So he said, no more flights to Hubble. And so we were on hold for quite some period of time, tried to look into how we might service Hubble robotically, but the technology just wasn't ready for that. I mean, it was an interesting idea, and a lot of creative engineering went into the thought about it, but it just was, the time wasn't ripe to do that. But then the new NASA administrator came along, and he re-examined the safety issues and found a way to assure that flying one more servicing mission to Hubble was a safe thing to do. And one of the ways was to have a spare shuttle on another launch pad ready to go in case the first shuttle got in trouble. And that made it the statistical calculations of risk to crew and to mission made it as safe. It's never safe, never totally safe, but made it as safe as it would be just to fly to the International Space Station. And on that basis, servicing mission 4 launched in May of 2009. And that was an incredible mission, very exciting, very problematical, but everything in the end came out all right. And the crew did a fantastic job of getting the telescope back up to full working capability, better than it had ever been before. And so that was our last servicing mission about 11 years ago. And the Hubble telescope is still as good as it's ever been, actually better than it's ever been prior to SM4. We still have issues with gyros, but we still have enough gyro capability to keep going for years into the future.
That's fantastic. I mean, it is amazing how, I suppose, was it built to last? Was it intended to go for 30 plus years, or is that just luck?
No, that's, well, therein lies a story that involves politics and you know, engineering and all kinds of issues and competition among different NASA missions. So the plan was Hubble was going to be launched in 1990. The original plan on paper at the time it was launched was it would be kept up and running for 15 years, so till 2005. And actually, the earliest idea about this within NASA in the early 1970s was it would be maintained as basically a permanent mountaintop observatory in space, the equivalent of a Palomar Mountain or Mount Wilson or the Anglo-Australian Telescope or any of these major observatories on the surface of the Earth that just last many, many, many decades. and are kept up to date, and they're maintained, and new instrumentation is put in them, and they keep doing frontier cutting edge science decade after decade. And so that was the original scheme. But then other factors entered the picture, like how expensive it was and so forth. And other missions came along that also had demands for NASA money. So the idea was we were going to be finished in 2005, last servicing, no more servicing. And then for the following 5 years, we were permitted to keep operating if we kept the cost really low, the cost of operations. And the idea was this freed up money for the James Webb Space Telescope, which many astronomers thought at the time would be superior to Hubble. I don't think it'll be superior. I think it'll be different from Hubble. It'll be complementary to Hubble. But it certainly was a much bigger telescope, and it certainly went much farther into the infrared, which is the where the game is, where all the action is. If you want to study the deep universe, the nature of the universe just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, when the very first stars and galaxies were starting to form, then if that's what you were into, then James Webb was the best game in town. And so the idea was to get James Webb built as quickly as possible. And the thought was with new technology and new schemes developed within industry, James Webb could be ready to fly in 2007 or 2008, and would cost perhaps $1 billion or less. And that put a lot of pressure on Hubble. We were still doing incredible science in that time frame, but the idea was phase Hubble down, free up the money, get James Webb started, and Hubble and James Webb will actually have a couple of years of overlap before we finally turn Hubble off in 2010. Now, just imagine, I mean, think about it. Had the Columbia accident not happened, Hubble would have been having its last servicing mission in, say, 2005, maybe 2004, but more likely 2005. And then the servicing capability goes away. And I really don't think Hubble telescope would have lasted until 2020 or beyond, by any means. In fact, I'm not sure it would have lasted until 2010. But every very dark cloud sometimes has a little bit of a silver lining. And in this case, the Columbia accident led to the many-year delay of servicing mission 4. And meantime, James Webb has had its own schedule and budget issues. So it did not fly in 2009 or 10, and it did not cost $500 million to $1 billion. And I think the people who were working on James Webb were very great people, the best of the best. They were working in good faith, but they just ran into one problem after another, which is kind of predictable for a very big space mission of this sort. Hubble had similar problems in the 1980s, running into technical delays and budget issues and so forth. So it's not surprising to me that James Webb was badly delayed, but had we gone through with NASA's original plan and had Hubble failed in 2008 or 9 or 10, something like that, we would have gone for a decade now without any major astronomical facilities operating in space, at least in the optical and infrared wavelength band and ultraviolet wavelength band. So was it originally planned for 30 years? Sort of. I mean, that was the original intent, but the actual original plan was 15 to 20 years. And as it was implemented by NASA, and we've just been really fortunate. I say fortunate, lucky, that implies lucky, and there is a lot of luck involved. But the way we have serviced Hubble over the years, when problems arose, we fixed them. And then new problems arose, and we fixed those. And pretty soon, all the so-called infant mortality or teenage mortality, you know, all the early lifetime mortality has been worked out of the system. And you have a system now that just it's just a matter of will it wear out at some stage? Will radiation exposure in space cause some of the electronic parts to stop working or stop working well? And So I think we're in that mature phase now where Hubble just keeps going along. And when a little problem arises, the engineers figure out how to work around it or fix it. I think the Kelly's heel still tends to be our gyros. We had 6 gyros working after the final servicing mission was completed. We're now down to 3. But with a more powerful spacecraft computer on board now, we have the software capability to operate Hubble with just 1 gyro. And we're down to 3. So yeah, eventually we'll get down to the last gyro failing, and that will be the end of Hubble. But I really think that's at least a few years in the future.
David, your book is full of anecdotes about people that you've worked with on Hubble, both astronomers and NASA scientists and engineers. And you clearly have a great respect and admiration for them. What was the relationship like between NASA and the Hubble user community?
Well, between NASA and the Hubble user community versus the overall Hubble project and the user community, maybe slightly different answers. But I would say in general, there are astronomers working today whose entire professional careers have been built with Hubble data, Hubble observations. It's not only a question of acquiring data from Hubble and using that in your research, but the Hubble program and NASA has funded in a modest way, I must say, relatively. Provided the funding needed to analyze and interpret those data. So basically, research programs, entire research programs, have been built in large part on Hubble observations and NASA funding. Also, of course, there are other sources of funding like the National Science Foundation in the U.S. But basically, astronomers owe their careers to Hubble, and to my knowledge, they are very grateful. I've had any number of astronomers tell me that they just would have gone nowhere without Hubble, in their opinion. The other thing I can point out is that Hubble is a democratic observatory, and I don't mean the political party. I mean democratically operated. So anyone in the world can apply, submit a proposal to observe with Hubble. And you're chosen or not chosen based on the merit of what you propose relative to all the other proposals. And the problem is there isn't enough time to go around on Hubble. So for every 5 proposals that are submitted, maybe only 1 can be selected. And you have to discard 4 other proposals, which may be very good proposals. But this is a process that allows anyone in the world to have an opportunity, fairly adjudged opportunity, to observe the Hubble Space Telescope. There, back in the day, it used to be that the so-called big glass, the big telescopes like the 200-inch at Mount Palomar, for example, to use that telescope, you had to be on the faculty of a particular university. And generally, it wasn't open to the full, to a wide-ranging public. And so that was very undemocratic. So I think, again, the community appreciates the fact that they have a fair chance to get observations and support funding from the Hubble program. I also think in the early days when spherical aberration first reared its ugly head, there were people who were angry and bitter against NASA, that somehow NASA had just completely messed this thing up and couldn't be relied on to do anything well. I think we put the lie to that by the response, NASA's response, and the first servicing mission, which corrected the problem. So I'm not aware now of anyone who's still angry with the Hubble project. So I think the relationship between NASA and the community has been incredibly good. I think the community is very aware of and grateful for the opportunities that they've been given. And I think Hubble has created a paradigm for an observatory in space and how you should operate it to extract the maximum scientific return. And I guess my final thought on this is that the major tool that we have used to extract this marvelous science over all the years, the most important tool, has been the collective intellect of the astronomical community all around the world. These are the people who had the creative ideas, how to use the telescope and its instruments to maximum effect to answer the most difficult questions. And NASA had the intent of enabling that, but it's been the community of astronomers, something like 7,000 users of Hubble over the years, that has had the creativity and ingenuity to get them to extract the maximum value for scientific research out of the instrumentation that we've provided for them. And so I kudos to astronomers for taking advantage of the opportunity.
And do you think that, that relationship will continue into the future as, you know, so sort of Hubble is switched off and the James Webb Space Telescope takes over? Is that the plan to continue that sort of relationship?
Yes. I mean, I think it is. Now, after a while, I mean, Hubble's 30 years old. At least Hubble in space is 30 years old. The actual instrumentation and the actual telescope is older than that. There are people alive today who have not known a world that didn't have a Hubble Space Telescope in it. In fact, if you're 30 years old, you were born about the time Hubble was born. So my point is, this is a capability that we might start taking for granted. I think if Hubble were suddenly to disappear or to turn off and we didn't have James Webb yet, I think suddenly the world would feel a little tsunami. I think, you know, it would be a very painful experience culturally as well as scientifically. Suddenly this thing we've had all these years and have gotten used to and have come to appreciate so much, taken for granted. It appears in our culture everywhere. Hubble imagery is just everywhere. We've taken that for granted, and if it suddenly disappeared, I just think people would take that very hard. And so I'm definitely hoping James Webb will continue. Of course, James Webb cannot be serviced in space, so it's going to be what it's going to be after it's launched. But it should have a lifetime of about 10 years or thereabouts. And so it should continue, and it'll be operated in the same way that Hubble was, a public observatory, democratically operated. Anyone in the world can apply to use it. And it's actually being operated by the Space Telescope Science Institute and to some extent by the Goddard Space Flight Center, as Hubble was. So that's sort of another decade, at least, of science from a bigger telescope, bigger light collecting area, more sensitive telescope that can reach farther into the infrared and therefore farther back in time and out across space than Hubble could. But then there are other missions coming along after that. The Roman Space Telescope, just recently renamed for Nancy Roman, who was the mother of the Hubble Space Telescope within NASA. So we have plans in the works for a continuing sequence of large, very capable telescopes, and Hubble has set the stage for this process.
Well, that's great, David. Some really interesting stories there about the technology and more importantly, the people who are involved with Hubble. David's book can be found in the eBooks section of IOP Science, and it's called Life with Hubble. Thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast, David.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Hamish.
The poster session has long been a staple of conferences, allowing researchers to present their work in an informal way, often over a coffee or a beer. A Twitter poster conference offers a way of replicating this online, as Physics World's Tammy Freeman finds out next.
Next week, IOP Publishing, which also publishes Physics World, is hosting its first Twitter poster conference. This is a free event that will enable researchers from around the globe to present their posters virtually. I'm speaking with Tim Smith, Associate Director at IOP Publishing, to find out more. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tammy. Great to be here.
What was the reason behind launching this new style of virtual event?
Well, I think as many of us have seen, the COVID-19 pandemic has had massive impact across many areas of science and the research community. And one thing that has definitely happened and it's impacted on are the conference circuit. Physical conferences this year, major ones such as the APS March meeting, have been cancelled. And it's been really interesting to see how the community have responded in a way that means that they can continue to disseminate and present their research to the wider community. IAP Publishing ourselves are also experimenting a little bit in terms of virtual conferences later this year. But with this event, the IOPP poster Twitter event, we saw an opportunity to experiment a little bit more with a platform that is gaining increasing traction amongst researchers across many areas of science. So what we really wanted to do was to launch an event covering all areas of science, not just physics, that provides researchers who use that social media platform to post some of their latest findings via posters that they might ordinarily have presented at conferences that have now been cancelled, but also to encourage perhaps greater engagement and discussion over a 24-hour period that might not be possible in the usual conference poster setting. Of course, one of the other real advantages of this is it's completely free. There are no registration costs and, of course, no travel costs associated with this virtual event.
Yeah, so sounds great. How will it actually work?
Well, the event itself is going to be running over a 24-hour period from the 15th of July to the 16th of July, starting at midday UK time. We have a web page with all of the essential information around the event, but essentially it's a four-step process. We're asking researchers to register in the first instance. That's a really important part because by registering, it means that a delegate's poster can be entered into a prize draw. We're then asking step two to create the poster itself, and then during the 24-hour period to upload the poster to Twitter using the hashtag IOPPPoster, and then really to wait and see what the reaction is and what the discussion is. And we're really hopeful that using the hashtags and using certain editors, board members, and IOPP staff, that we'll be able to encourage and trigger conversation around these posters over a prolonged 24-hour period.
So this will be like people commenting on Twitter on the posters, asking questions, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yes, and we have a team of IOPP people and also some board members as well who will be very much part of that discussion and debate and be asking some of those questions.
Okay, and you said that the poster conference includes all areas of physics.
Actually, it's broader than physics. It certainly covers all areas of physics, but it's actually covering all of science. So we're talking here physics, materials, the biosciences, chemistry, engineering, environmental science, and mathematics and computation. So, you know, with this pilot event, we really wanted to take the opportunity to make this as big as possible and as relevant as possible to as many scientists as we could. And we're really hoping to learn a great deal in terms of the reaction, the take up from the scientific community to this, and to understand a little bit more perhaps about how different areas of science are now engaging with social media and in Twitter in this way. Each of those seven big subject areas will have a hashtag associated with them themselves to just aid the scientific discussion in a slightly more granular way. So again, we hope that this will really incite that kind of conversation and engagement on Twitter.
Okay, and you mentioned something about prizes being awarded to winning posters. So who gets to choose the winners?
Well, each of these seven core areas of the coverage will have a chair associated with them, and these chairs will be actually associated with one specific journal, IOP SciNotes, and I'll expand on that a little bit later on, I think, in the conversation, plus some other board members associated with IOP's journals extending across the the physical sciences. A really important point, I said it at the beginning, is that in order to qualify for the prize draw, delegates or participants, let's say, in the event, must register via the webpage. So, you know, I really do encourage the community to Google IOPP poster, and register via that webpage to ensure that you're eligible for the prize. And then our panel of experts for each of the seven areas will then be selecting their best poster of all of those that are uploaded based on presentation style, the scientific rigor, the quality of the results, and the interest and broader appeal of the poster itself. Each of the subject categories, the seven subject categories that the conference will cover, provides therefore participants with a chance to win what will be £100 plus an IOP ebook of their choice. And as I say, those winners will be selected by the subject chairs made up of a range of board members from IOP journals in the specialist fields.
Okay. Now you briefly touched upon IOP Synotes. Now I gather this is a new journal, which, like the conference, also covers all areas of physical and environmental sciences. Could you tell me a little bit more about this new journal?
Yeah, so IOP Synotes is a really exciting and unique new journal launch for IOP Publishing. It's now open for submissions, and in fact, we published the very first papers just a few weeks ago. And its launch is aligned with our own Open Physics program of activity that sees IOP's commitment to supporting the wider adoption of open practices across the physical sciences. And a principal aim for our Open Physics program is to essentially increase access, transparency, and inclusivity as a driver that accelerates scientific discovery. Now, IOP Synotes itself supports open, transparent, and reproducible approaches to discovery, and has really been designed as a formal publication forum for scientific material that may not be in a format ready or appropriate for publication in a traditional full-length article. And in doing so, what the journal does is it provides authors with publication credit and an outlet for all of the research work that deserves long-term archival preservation for future reference. Quite unique to IOP Synotes are the various study types that the journal will publish. And this will include reports of new results or observations, negative or reproduced results, descriptions of new methods or protocols, descriptions of data and code, and also actually registered methodological reports. And a principal driver for IOP Synotes is really to ensure that our editorial practices are inclusive and as diverse as possible, in the interest of adding real value to the scientific communication process.
That's great. And I mean, as you said, I guess the board of this new journal are helping you run the Twitter conference. So it all sort of works together really nicely.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that one of the aims for IOP Synotes is to break down perhaps the traditional units of research, the article, into smaller components to give publication credit for those, we saw that having a kind of a real synergy, if you like, to posters themselves as smaller outputs or reports of new research. And obviously the timing of IOP Synotes launch with this Twitter event also was a great opportunity for us to align the two features. And as you say, the editorial board of IOP Synotes will play a particular role as in terms of the subject chairs for some of the areas that the conference will cover.
Great. And do you think that this Twitter poster conference will become a regular event?
Quite possibly. We're really hoping to learn a great deal from it. We're not the first publisher to run poster events on Twitter, but we think we're the very first to run one that really covers the whole of science. We decided to do that in a big way and to brand it as an IOP publishing event, albeit with a strong connection to IOP Synotes. But what we're really excited to see is what the take-up is from the different communities that this particular conference will cover, and whether there are some learning points that means that we might do perhaps some more granular subject-specific poster events in the future. But we're really excited about what this could mean. And one of the things we've definitely noticed this year more than any other is the sheer level of scientific discussion, dissemination that goes on social media in general, but particularly Twitter. So, you know, we're really pleased to be helping to add to that add to that discussion forum through this event.
Great. So that's next Wednesday and Thursday at hashtag IOPP poster. Well, thanks very much, Tim, for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Tim Smith in conversation with Tammy Freeman. And please do check out the Twitter Podcast Conference next week. That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to David LaCrone, Tim Smith, and Tammy Freeman for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.